You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
So if I may introduce on my left Vonda Felbab-Brown, who is a fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. Many of you will know of her work. There she studies internal and external conflict issues and their management, particularly looking at organized crime, illicit economies, and law enforcement. Her research has taken her to Afghanistan, Pakistan, Southeast Asia, Mexico, Colombia, the Horn of Africa, many places that the Open Society Foundations and many of you will have worked in as well. So we're hoping that there'll be many opportunities for interaction between the work that we undertake and the research that she has done. Her last book was Shooting Up, Counterinsurgency in the War on Drugs, that examined efforts to optimize counter-narcotics policies within a counterinsurgency strategy. As a part of her OSF fellowship, Dr. Felbab-Brown will be looking at a research into 7 illicit economies, and I think they were listed, but it's a very wide range, looking at drug smuggling, smuggling of nuclear materials, logging, wildlife, gems, human trafficking, and the illicit economy of modern piracy. She's looking at these in various areas around the world, including India, Burma, Brazil, and more recently, Indonesia. Her research will look at the questions as to the ways that these different illicit economies and networks are similar, and the ways that they are completely different. From the proposal for her publication, it's clear that there are effects from all of these illicit economies on the political state, causing international costs to the country concerned, weakening judiciary through corruption, bribery, and threats to the justice process. There are serious economic effects to such illicit economies, obviously, and then environmental effects that are perhaps often underestimated by those who don't know the exact cost of them, as well as the more obvious economic effects to the economy at large when there's an entire shadow economy worth millions or billions of dollars that's operating at the same time. And her research will also look at the methods that are used to counter these problems, looking at what works, what doesn't, looking at whether the simplistic way of just either putting pressure on supply or putting pressure on demand is enough, or whether you need to go beyond that. Is education sufficient to prevent these illicit mechanisms such as migration from operating? Offering alternatives. Is it possible to destroy these networks? Or if by destroying the network, will something else just move into the void? But all of these are questions that the research will be looking at. And so today, Vonda's going to look at, firstly, the conceptual framework for her research, looking at the comparative policy analysis as to what works and what does not. Looking at the question of the illegality or illegitimacy of these illicit networks when you're dealing with something that employs millions of people around the world, to what extent can you just ban it, or what extent have you got to look at whether it is illegitimate rather than illegal? What is the chain, the structure, the trade network that is used for each of them, and what recommendations are there to suppress the trades that they operate? And then the second part, she's going to look at the question of her more recent research in Indonesia and Southeast Asia, and look in particular at why policies have failed in that area. And so we look forward to hearing the presentation. Then there'll be about an hour or so for questions, and I've suggested there's an awful lot of people here who are working in some of these areas, and I think we'll be asking questions about where civil society can respond to the research that you're doing, and ways that OSF could respond and might take on new projects that will be relevant to the work that you're doing. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Rupert. I feel like you have perhaps given a good chunk of my presentation already. It was a very succinct summary. I also have to say that actually my last book is called Aspiration and Ambivalence, Strategies and Realities of Counterinsurgency and State Building. And it's just out and being launched at Brookings next week. And a friend in the Pentagon said, no, this is a book on Afghanistan that has all the questions you ever wanted to ask and really don't want to hear the answers. So if any of you are interested in Afghanistan and lessons about state building and counterinsurgency, especially as we are now planning on having an invasion in Mali and very aggressively being involved in Somalia, not to mention the stabilization and reconstruction community descending on Burma, in flocks. That might be stuff in aspiration ambivalence that's of interest to you. But the book that I am working for under the OSF grant is tentatively called Managing Illicit Economies, Organized Crime, Law Enforcement, and Human Security. And I specifically call it Managing Illicit Economies, although the title is still tentative and I might still come up with something more grabby. Because a core argument in a lot of my work, including the work in the book, is that many of these illicit economies really cannot be effectively eliminated. It's almost as illusory as talking about eliminating organized crime. And really what policy does is essentially trade harms. So different policy designs result in different trade-offs between various harms with various costs and consequences. And so essentially what the role of policymakers and society in large is allocating harms that these economies will pose. These economies pose very substantial harms, sometimes to threats, sometimes partially because they are illegal. However, many of these illicit economies also exist in a legal form, and frequently the harms can be as acute, as intense, as chronic, and as detrimental to both the state and society as their illegal form. And I would say that in many ways that's a key sort of finding of the research, because more and more there is a lot of tendency to suggest that regulatory design itself, specifically legality or illegality, is the driver of violence and corruption. And so, you know, the book in many ways is sort of a refutation of that claim, even though it doesn't sort of set out itself to ask this the question. Essentially what the book is a comparative analysis of policy effectiveness with respect to policies that have been attempted to these seven illicit economies that are nuclear smuggling to non-state actors. So what I'm not looking at is general proliferation such as Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon. I'm specifically looking at the non-state actor aspect. And the reason why I'm looking at that in the chapter is because in some ways it is the hardest problem, one where traditional deterrence fails or is believed to fail. And then what can one do with signaling, are there any deterrence mechanisms left? And specifically because non-state actors, criminal organizations would be the most likely conduit of fissile materials to terrorist groups with absolutely disastrous consequences. I'm also looking at drug smuggling, on which I have done a lot of work in across the world, maritime piracy, wildlife trafficking, illegal logging, illegal mining, and human trafficking. And economies like logging and mining, of course, exist in a legal form. And indeed, often the distinction between what is legal and what is illegal might be minimal to non-existent. So take something like a big mining thing, the biggest mining corporation in Indonesia, called KPC, is the biggest business conglomerate in general, that is issued a license for mining on the edge of a national park, and has done so by bribing local officials. They have a license, they're paying taxes, perhaps not as much as they should, there is a great deal of tax evasion. Nonetheless, it is at the discretion of the local official that they were issued a license. The local officials are going to bribe. Is this illegal economy that's being perverted, that's being being mitigated via inappropriate means, illegal means, or is it illegal economy? Is the difference really between the behavior of KPC fundamentally different than the behavior of a miner who will go into the park with the pan? Now, the logger might also go into the park, but so much KPC be operating with a license in the middle of national park. The public official is clearly issuing the law in violations of certain set of regulations, but he's following another set of regulations. So often there is a very slippery slope between what legality and illegality means. So the book is structured essentially by these different illicit economies, and I can talk about in the question and answer period why and how they were selected. And in each of the illicit economies, I look at what threats, what harms and threats the illicit economy poses. What is the structure of the illicit economy? So what is the chain of actors involved, from the entry-level producers through the ultimate consumers and all the intermediaries in between? What are the major loci of the illicit economy? Now, I make choices. Most of these illicit economies are present virtually everywhere in the world. There are some exceptions to it. Nuclear smuggling, at least of fissile materials, is far more localized, but something like poaching and wildlife trafficking will be present in very large parts of the world. So the way I pick the illustrations in the chapter, essentially, is to show either variations on policy choices, on variations or outcomes, or sort of variations of different aspects of the phenomena. I'll talk about that a bit more. And then finally, I look at government responses, as well as all other, including non-government policies that have been attempted. So I look at all the policies that have been tried, and in some circumstances, like in the nuclear chapter, I talk about policies that could be imagined on the supply side, on the transshipment side, and on the demand side. And then look at what the effectiveness of the outcome is with respect to mitigating the threats and perhaps reducing the size of the illicit economy. And finally, each chapter then concludes with policy implications / policy recommendations. Often it stays more at the level of policy implications. There is a structural, a theoretical argument that's run through the book, and that is, well, there are several. So apart from the one that I started the conversation with by saying that the regulatory framework, the regulatory design is a key aspect of policy effectiveness, but it's only one aspect. The local institutional setting matters as much. And what a policy that works very well in one particular locality when transposed to locality with different institutional and cultural setting might be completely ineffective. So take something like the criminalization of marijuana in the Netherlands. It's frequently used as the model for marijuana decriminalization. And the policy was rather effective. It was based on the key objective of the policy was to separate users from dealers that would also introduce them to hard drugs. So the purpose of the policy was to reduce the amount of use of hard drugs. The argument was marijuana is not per se a gateway to hard drugs. Marijuana is a gateway to hard drugs because it puts users in contact with dealers that will introduce them to other substances as well. So if we can supply marijuana via other dealers, we will eliminate this problem. And from this perspective, it was rather effective. The policy generated a whole host of other consequences, some of which were quite uncomfortable for the Netherlands, and the legislation in the Netherlands is becoming tougher and tougher. They are quite radically backtracking from the original design. But nonetheless, this aspect of the policy, in my view, worked very well. What the Dutch legislation also did was sort of decriminalization plus, because not only did they decriminalize, but they also set up these coffee shops where sales up to certain amounts were legal. Now, where the policy had a huge hole was that wholesale supply to the coffee shops was and continues to be illegal. So there was always a officially sanctioned illegal element of the policy, or of the regulatory system, that police would at times enforced and other times not enforced, but it generated lots of confusion and problems and continues to be a problem for the legislation. Now, the criminalization based on the Dutch model was later adopted in Brazil. And the goal in the Brazilian decriminalization was not simply to remove users from suppliers of hard drugs. It was more broadly to not burden law enforcement officials with having to focus on arrests based on use, of improving public health, of perhaps improving human rights of users. And the criminalization did not simply apply to marijuana, it also applied to other substances. So certain amount of other substances as well, up to a personal limit, would now not be would now not be enforced, people would not be arrested for it. But it essentially did not achieve any of the objectives because the police ended up specifically looking and for and booking users who would be coming to the favelas to buy their personal use and threatening them with booking them of having more than the allowed limit and unless they pay the bribe. So prior to that, you have a very corrupt, very abusive Brazilian police that would be extorting users, sometimes arresting them, other times demanding money. You have a legislation passed that's supposed to undo part of that problem. Essentially doesn't, because the Brazilian police continues to act in the same corrupt manner that it did before and continues to extort users as well as control markets or access to markets in the same way that it did before. So we have a similar design with somewhat different objectives, but very different institutional and cultural context with very different outcomes. So that's one theme that runs through the book. Let me give you another example. In the chapter on wildlife trafficking, I talk about the effects of bans and the effects of allowing legal supply, namely either allowing a certain culling of animals from the wild or farming of animals for legal supply. Legal supply worked brilliantly with respect to crocodilians. It served crocodiles, alligators, and other species of crocodilians from extinction. Huge demand for purses, clothing, what have you. When there was no ban, you had huge overharvesting. Then there was a ban, you have huge overharvesting. It was legal supply farming that saved the species from extinction, essentially. You have a similar legislation or similar regulatory design adopted with respect to pangolins, which are being vastly used for traditional Chinese medicine, and it hasn't worked. It hasn't worked for many reasons. One is that the breeding on the farms is much harder. Another one that many of the producers still find it much easier to cull the animals from the wild and claim that they raise them on the farm, so they just launder the animals through the farming, deflecting law enforcement, but you have still massive collapse of the species in the wild.
So which animal was that?
Pangolin. It's a mammal. It's a scaly mammal that sort of looks like an anteater, but it's scaled that lives in Asia. Take the reverse policy, a ban on a species. It worked very well with the vicuñas, which is an antelope in Peru and Latin America. Came close to extinction. The fur is very desirable for coats. The species was hunted, came close to an extinction. There was a ban on hunting. The species recovered rather robustly. Take a ban on elephants. The 1990s ban, the first ban, introduced as a result of mainly European demand for ivory. Big success. The ban is in existence and is completely collapsing, or the effectiveness of the ban is completely collapsing because of the entrance of primary China and other East Asian countries onto the market, and you have massive violations of the ban, massive collapse. The first ban reduced demand, or the ban in the first instance in the 1990s reduced demand in Europe. The fact that it's banned has absolutely no effect on East Asian consumers, and so despite the ban, you have massive culling, and in fact the ban continues to push prices up. So you have very different outcome. In one case, it works very well with the very same species. In another case, it doesn't work very well. So you have huge variation in outcomes. And although I'm very much a fan of lessons learned and best practices, the best practices will only become best practices if they are very firmly anchored in a huge deal of specificity. Local specificity, in the case of environmental protection, environmental specificity as well. The second sort of general claim that runs through these different illicit economies is that the structure of the illicit economy privileges policy interventions in certain spaces. And by structure, I mean essentially the visibility and concentration on supply, transshipment, or demand. So if you have highly concentrated supply, highly visible supply, for example, for fissile material, your best policy intervention is to try to lock up supply. On the other hand, if you have a very widely dispersed supply, even if it seems nominally to be visible, take something like logs, they are big things, there is only so much that law enforcement on supply side can get you to. You would think that the trees, especially hardwood trees in the tropics, are very visible objects. In reality, the action time from satellite detection to implementation on the ground is too long. It's really hard to enforce on supply. So you can do things on supply, but there will be your supply interventions will be of limited effectiveness, unless in this case you can focus on demand. Now, demand is very difficult in this case because you have both very dispersed, quite invisible supply and very dispersed, quite invisible demand for timber products. Nonetheless, how you want to think about responding to both demand or supply then depends on the specific local manifestation. So it's a very different policy design issue if your logging is principally taking place for the hardwood. What you then want to think about is, can you legally source in an environmentally friendly manner hardwoods from other countries, via plantation, etc., via licensing, for example. Then if your problem is logging or deforestation, that's not for hardwoods per se, but for access to land, so for agricultural purposes. Your response is very different. Can you find other land that's already degraded or that is not being in use and doesn't face the same environmental consequences as your approach? Or can you think about sort of improving agricultural practices? For example, in much of the Latin America or Asia where you have major cattle ranching, the ineffectiveness of cattle ranching is enormous. There's huge die-off of cattle because veterinary practices are non-existent or poor, hence the land being allocated to cattle is much larger. So can you, for example, introduce medicine so they don't lose 90% of the stock or 50% of the stock, and then can farm on a much smaller area? And the regulatory response will look very different if the principal cause of deforestation is artisanal logging for household energy needs or for construction material. What you want to think about in that case is, can you provide energy sources in a more environmentally friendly manner, or can you provide alternative building material, such as bamboo, for example? Also, I want to sort of some of the general takeaways, and I'm very happy to get into the sort of specifics of each of the illicit economies. And there's huge amounts of detail that applies to the illicit economy, to the particular illicit economies that we can talk about. I would make sort of two large general observations. One is that a very much favored policy for mining, logging, fisheries, the wildlife market, and to some extent even drugs has become licensing. So if the product is produced in some desirable manner, then it gets a license. For example, the Kimberley process for diamonds was the mother of licensing, right? So the idea was that these diamonds are not feeding conflict, hence they get a license and they can be exported, and consumers don't have to be guilty about, don't feel guilty about using them. And that has become sort of the norm for many other economies that exist in a legal form and where people don't want to completely make them illegal. I think that one needs to be very cautious, and there is a huge amount of licensing failure, in my view. A lot of the licenses are really certifying the still same undesirable activity. So there's huge limitations of what the certification can actually discover. There's huge limitations on what the inspectors can accomplish, what they can actually inspect. The reality is that as licensing is becoming extraordinarily prevalent, most of the licensing, most of the certificates are being issued by inspectors who are hired by the company. So if a company is selling African oil, they want to hire, they themselves pay for the inspectors. And so you have huge variation in the quality of certification, but even with the trusted ones, essentially they have such limits on investigating any particular area that a lot of the licenses are very shabby. And what you are ending up with is certifying activity that was previously identified as undesirable, that has often not really changed very much in behavior of impact. But now you have also really whitewashed the conscience of the consumer, because now there is licensing, and so purchasing that product is fine. I think there's huge limitations to what licensing can accomplish, and unless there is a major army of independent inspectors for a variety of these illicit economies being stood up and paid not by the companies, but that they're paid by governments or non-profits, I don't think it's going to really accomplish as much as we would hope. The second comment I would make is about alternative livelihoods, which is something I worked on for a long time with respect to drugs. It's also something that comes up with respect to almost all of the economies, almost all of them. Certainly wildlife trafficking, you want to think about alternative livelihoods for poachers. Mining, logging, your artisanal level entrants often are people who are desperately poor, very willingly participate in the illegal economy and critically depend on the illegal economy for basic subsistence. So very marginalized people who live through illegality. And so you don't want to simply deal with them for human rights reasons as well as for policy efficacy reasons through punitive law enforcement measures. You want to offset the losses in economic dependence that they feel. So the approach frequently is alternative livelihoods. And it's more or less a story of utter dismal failure. There are some exceptions to alternative livelihoods. In the drug case, since Thailand is the one big success story that was never replicated anywhere else. But if you look at something like alternative livelihoods for illegal logging, disaster for artists and loggers, most of the time doesn't work, doesn't accomplish anything. For poaching, I would say it's even worse. So you have small, sort of very, very sporadic successes, but they are very small, very sporadic. And when they need to be scaled up, it essentially doesn't work. I can get in the Q&A answer why this is happening. Let me now make some comments. How much more time do I have? 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me make some comments about the Indonesia research. So I was there, that's part of the OSF grant, was to go to Indonesia and East Africa. I have previously done work on issues either tangent or directly relevant to the book project in elsewhere in South Asia, in Latin America, also in Sub-Saharan Africa. But so the empirical part that I was supplementing the research with was Indonesia and East Africa, where I'm still to go. So I was in Indonesia for about 2 months and interviewed about 100 people on 7 of the islands. I looked at 5 illicit economies, logging, mining, poaching, human trafficking, and maritime piracy. And I also picked up a side project not related to the OSF grant and looking at urban gangs. It's another thing that I know a lot about and have worked on urban gangs in South America as well as in South Asia. And I happened to sort of land in Indonesia, where a lot of very fascinating stuff was happening with urban gangs in Jakarta, and ended up in the nighttime looking at that as well. Overall, I would say it was a dismal story of a sort of great, ultimately great research access, but more or less unmitigated failure of policy regulation. And not because the frameworks in many of these cases were deeply misdesigned, but essentially because there's close to no rule of law in Indonesia. The justice system is completely corrupt. And not only is police corrupt in the traditional way that you frequently see police, a critical thing is that both the police and the military depend on about a third of their institutional budget on all budget income. And the way they get this income is from logging, mining, fishing, just any of the natural resources that are being exploited in Indonesia. Now, that is something that has been known. This goes back to the Suharto era, at least over the past decade. But the government has found no capacity and willingness to either force the military and the police to trim the institutions to stay within the allocated official budget or to punish them for going out for a third of their budget, an enormous amount, right, of budget sources. So the police and the military continue to be key drivers of a variety of the illicit economies. But you also have very dysfunctional power devolution that was very well motivated by the in the post-Suharto era to allow greater access of voters to see the management of resources. In practice, it created unaccountable resource barons that operate at the level of province, regency, and even village head that often act in violations of national laws, yet Jakarta has been meek, apathetic, and quite unwilling to rein in the local officials and start exercising more power, or even to then think about perhaps more constitutional rebalancing of power. So essentially, you have both official illegal behavior, illegal logging by poor loggers or illegal mining by poor miners that do not have licenses, but you have many official big companies issued licenses that are very problematic, and they violate the licenses all the time. So either they bribe to get the license, most of the time everyone bribes. One of the things that the devolution of power did was to also complicate bribery structures. Under the Suharto era, bribery was very centralized. Suharto and family got 10%, 15% cut on everything. Now bribery involves very many actors and in many ways is far more complicated and opaque and generates a sort of even greater inefficiency, but nonetheless the devolution does not address the greater accountability for voters. There is quite a bit of transparency in Indonesia, and NGOs often expose bad behavior. But what was quite disheartening, really, is that exposure of behavior does not lead to any change in activity or any sort of punishment. So you have, under the Suharto era, you had corruption and bad behavior with opaqueness. Under the current era, you have corruption and bad behavior with transparency. You have impunity with transparency. You have sort of instances of local success, of local mobilization that would shut down some illegal mines or that would stop some logging. But they are very sporadic, very limited, nothing on the systemic level. And most of the time, the NGOs feel fundamentally disempowered and expect the international NGOs to do all the heavy lifting and really pressure the legislation or Congress. Congress, by the way, is a bunch of... let me phrase it differently. There are very many very, very problematic actors in Congress, and arguably the greatest obstacle to the improvements of policy design and, more importantly, policy implementation is Congress, where many members have either criminal records or criminal indictments or would have criminal indictments were they not members of Congress. That is not, you know, very vastly different than India, for example, when a third of Congress is under indictment for very serious murder, rape, sort of crime. But the fact that they are in Congress gives them immunity, so they have no incentives ever to leave Congress. In with respect to the local officials, which are a key part of the problem, there is elections of local officials, but what is a sort of typical story in many parts of the world, including South and Southeast Asia, is that voters are very easily seducible to vote on the basis of minimal immediate before election handouts. And so you end up having the same people who promise, never deliver, and sort of use the public office to generate resources for their very small immediate clique being elected over and over. And even if they are not elected, it is the wife that's elected or it is the son. So you have the creation of these dynastical families, again, quite a typical story of Southeast Asia. But the fact that voters have greater transparency and the fact that voters have a say now in the way they didn't have is insufficient to encourage voters behaving voting in a way that's more reasonable, that's punishing bad leaders, essentially. And immediate pre-election handouts are sufficient to vote once again for the same person. There is one exception, and then I'll conclude with that, to the overall very discouraging story. I also, two things I'll say. I've been in forests and seen forests in many parts of the world, including elsewhere in Southeast Asia. So, for example, I spent lots of time in forests on the Malaysian side of Borneo. I've never seen forests as shredded and destroyed as I have seen them in Indonesia. Even areas that are national parks are essentially devastation zones, with mining, logging, most of them have been logged out, poaching, anyone doesn't want anything they want. The fact that something is designated national park mostly doesn't have a meaning. Most of the national parks are areas that have previously been mined and logged to start with that become commercially less interesting, so they're designated. But even after they're designated national parks, because they are not commercially interesting anymore, they continue to just face no enforcement, whatever. It was a rather absolute shocking story. On the Malaysian side, you will find huge deforestation and tiny areas designated as protected areas. But when something is designated as protected areas, it's enforced. You don't have that essentially on the Indonesian side. And you have often lots of the same Malaysian logging or mining companies operate in Indonesia as well in strikingly different way because they encounter a very different law enforcement, rule of law environment. It's also not a function of poverty. Nepal is a much, much poorer country than Indonesia with many fewer resources. Yet there is some effort to protect the national parks. Lots of deforestation taking place, but some effort to enforce. You almost don't see it with respect to Indonesia. And so the Indonesians are now in this big negotiations with Norway for the Red Plus money. I can get into that. And if the Norwegians are going to transfer a lot of funds, in my view, they will be buying much less than the money they are going to be transferring. There is one exception to the overall dismal story, and that is maritime piracy. So, you know, human trafficking also was a very unhappy story. There is one success, one big regulatory success, and it's maritime piracy, which used to be massive in the Moluccas in the mid-1990s, early 2000s, as well as historically going back to the 19th century. And all of a sudden, you have a very effective action that essentially ends piracy. At the same time as piracy is rising up of West Africa and East Africa. Why? Why was that the success? And can that success then be translated for thinking about action in other domains in Indonesia? The answer to the first question is that essentially the structure of incentive was such that it favored enforcement. The Singaporean government paid essentially for the Indonesians to enforce. Had the Singaporeans for their own interest not provided the monies, the Jakarta would have been dragging their feet. The amount of profits generated by piracy were very small. The pirates never managed to seize big ships like they do off of Africa. So instead of bringing in a million or two per ship, they would be bringing in a few thousand per ship. So the bribes that were then following to local officials on the coast, as well as the Coast Guard primarily, were very small. So they would be bribing individuals, but it didn't amount to massive institutional resource transfer. And so then the hits of enforcing were relatively limited. The local officials were not happy. The individuals in the Coast Guard were not happy. But you didn't have a sort of systematic, we'll say, rebalancing, restructuring of relationship between Jakarta and, say, the Coast Guard, because the profits were very, very limited. And the costs were potentially large. Hence, although it worked very well, it's also sadly not replicable to the other domains, which are bringing vast amounts of money. The one exception where some of the lessons can perhaps be applied to is human trafficking, but I'll leave that for the Q&A.
Well, thank you very much. A fascinating trip around the world. And you've demonstrated the complicated nature of these different structures, the nuanced changes between them, which means that any responses from governments and civil society have got to be equally well thought through if they're not going to fall into that larger pot of being a failure. So let's see. Questions? Who would like to... Can you introduce who you are so that others who may not know who you are?
Hi, I'm Betsy Apple from the Justice Initiative. Thanks a lot for your remarks. I really appreciate it. It's very sobering. I'm curious to know how connected these illicit economies are to each other and whether there are spillover effects when you have a successful intervention with respect to, say, logging and how that affects mining and gems, et cetera, on a local or regional basis. Thanks.
It depends. So in some domains, you have a lot of connections, both perhaps in the positive spillover and often in the negative spillover. In other areas, they have quite separate phenomena. So in the Indonesian case, you have very thick connections, but in a way that you don't want to see them. So essentially, the first big industry was the logging industry, and started operating in the 1980s and really kicked into place in the 1990s. And the industry very quickly became bloated. It operated in both legal and illegal manner, so they would be issued licenses, but the licenses were meaningless, and they kept violating the licenses and logged out far more than was sustainable. So the industry was eating its tail, and at some point it started eating its body, and the whole economy would fall out because you have so much over-exploitation. So what the happy outcome of that would have been a big crash of the logging industry with some very serious consequences for the companies. Because then perhaps they would have learned that unsustainable management of resources ultimately is not in their own interest either. But instead they learned they can relocate their operations just like the Chinese and the Taiwanese and Thai did to sub-Saharan Africa, Congo, South. And also that they can move to other illegal economy, or other resource economies, namely mining. So where you see a lot of migration out of the logging industry into either plantations, African oil, or mining. And they're behaving equally in a not sustainable way, with operating horizons being, you know, 10, 20 years. And that's the extent, that's how short-term the horizons are for public officials and lots of these companies. But the hope is, well, we'll be able to go elsewhere, whether elsewhere domestically or elsewhere abroad. And they also, I think, learned lots of the tricks, like, you know, how much should we be worried about certification. As one of the miners, one of the official mining companies told me, I asked him about green certification for logging and mining and the expansion of Lacey Act. And he said, look, it's just another bribery item. It will call me 5 billion rupees. Other cases, you also have criminal organizations very quickly learning a certain skill set. In other of my work, I talk about technology of illegality. So if people learn how to sort of smuggle, evade, and effectively corrupt, they can use that skill set to other economies. So the fact that you suppress one doesn't mean that you have eliminated organized crime. You often encourage them to switch to other illegal economies. Now, unlike many scholars, I do not believe that there is a complete flexibility for criminal groups to switch. In fact, I would argue that there are real, very substantial barriers before a criminal group can become truly polycrime group. There are limits to how much they can switch, and it's not the right argument to say they smuggle in frogs, they will take fissile materials. I strongly argue against that. But nonetheless, there is a certain skill set, certain technology of illegality that can be shifted often. And so what is often completely falls out of the public policy debate is, okay, we have this big problem with drugs, so we need to suppress drugs. Well, and then ipso facto, the argument is organized crime will end. That's rarely the case. They will look for other stuff to switch. And often what they can switch into is far more detrimental to society or the state than the original illicit economy. And so these second and third degree effects need to be far more systematized into public policy discussions and policy design that we have seen.
Thank you. Let's go around this way. I'm just going to go around the table.
Hi, my name is Sanjay Patel. I work for the harm reduction program within public health. And my work focuses on improving police behavior towards drug users, and Indonesia is actually one of the countries that I have grantees in. And so a couple of questions related to the police in Indonesia. One, when I previously worked in India, it was common knowledge that on the border between Rajasthan and Gujarat, police would bid basically for the postings, because Gujarat is a dry state, and so the alcohol trade was very lucrative. So if you were an SP based on the border, it was a lot of money in your pocket. So you essentially had this auction, informal auction, for those postings. I'm wondering, in Indonesia, what I've heard is that sort of what you said actually during your presentation, which is that the decentralization has resulted in many different results. One being that what I've heard is that police who are stationed out in some of the outlying provinces are kind of laws in and of themselves, and the Indonesian National Police headquarters, Jakarta, has very little control over some of the chiefs of police within the provinces. I was wondering whether they bid for these postings, because I'm sure it's quite lucrative when you're based out of some of the provinces where the bulk of the logging takes place. You know, if you're the chief of police or somebody sort of equivalently superior in the ranking, it can be quite lucrative, I imagine. And so I was just wondering if that bidding takes place and how does that sort of relate to the center, to Jakarta INP? And then the second question I had was, when I've been in Indonesia, there's been a lot of talk about drug trafficking as subsidizing insurgent movements. And so the U.S. is funding a lot of the sort of counterinsurgent training of police for the purposes of curtailing not only those insurgent movements, but the drug trafficking that fuels or subsidizes, rather, allegedly. I was just curious whether your work covered any of that and what thoughts you have on that.
So police, there is certainly a great deal of manipulations of people, how people get posted to particular areas. So there are areas that are not desirable because there is active violence against police. And so no one really wants to be posted into Ambon, for example. There was a big insurgency throughout 1990s, sort of middle area, and there is not much money to be made unless you can penetrate the wildlife trafficking market. Then that aspect of it is very lucrative, but it doesn't come to the amount of money that you'll get out of being posted in Papua. That is, the Papua and Halmahera are the areas to be posted to, where both the military and the police are both the major organized crime entities as well as the major rule entities, major power entities. So the human trafficking networks in these areas are often run by the military and the police, for example. They will have also a cut of tax on any commodity that will be flown into those areas. So there is a real incentive to be posted to some areas and real incentives not to be posted to some areas, which a lot has to do with bribes. So you have sort of bidding in terms of bribes, but a lot also has to do with cultivating good friends and allies, especially in the military command. That's quite strong networks, and often it's the membership in the clique rather than sort of neutral level of bribery, if you will, sort of open bribery rather than open bribery process is membership being friends with the right person. So classic nepotistic clientelistic structure that will be determinative of how people are posted. Now, the people, officials, police, the military officials are frequently, as well as public servants, so civil servants, are frequently posted to any area for a very short amount of time, 3 to 6 months. And that's specifically done so that they will not become ensnared in local corruption resource networks. In practice, it doesn't work that way at all. And what it means is that you have very short amount of time to make a lot of money very quickly. So not only you want to be, you want to get these resources, you need to do it quickly. That might generate sort of methods such as abuse and thuggishness, as opposed to try to cultivate a lot of local actors. But nonetheless, you will also have the emergence of relationship between local officials and the outside posted police or military officials, and that will be very important and very thick to the cultivation. What it does not encourage, of course, is sort of get to know the community and be liked by the community. Because the amount of time is short, you have a very short amount of time to make the money. There's family pressures, you know, why should you be the good guy? Everyone is making money on this, you know, what kind of schlep are you if you're not coming home to the family with the money? Now, you know, I am speaking in big generalizations. Obviously, you have exceptions. You have sort of the occasional police officer, police captain in an area that all of a sudden is far less corrupt, maybe not corrupt, and really tries hard. And so it's these admirable agents of change that need to be rewarded. But often they're punished by Jakarta. They are not rewarded because they will generate threats to superiors. If you have a lot of sort of constant level of abuse and corruption, and then all of a sudden one starts behaving very, very well, it generates problems for your colleagues. Now, you know, you, you have sort of also change in the story. The guy who was currently elected to be the mayor of Jakarta, a post that source a lot of money, is a big exception. He's widely seen as far less corrupt, far more focused on the public, with connecting with the people, based on his performance in Solo and another city. And so, you know, here voters voted truly to pick on the basis of an enlightened self-interest. How he will do in Jakarta is open question mark. He is allied with the former head of, he has declared his support for a former head of special forces in Indonesia, a person who is denied visas to the US on human rights abuses and who is the leading candidate for president. And he has, you know, made alliance with him. Perhaps that's necessary for political survival, but the verdict is still out. But so, you know, you have people who occasionally can break out of the system. On the drugs and insurgents, yeah, I know if you really want to be very bad, you not only want to be a terrorist, but hopefully a narco-terrorist. So that is a huge sort of premium to be paid on labeling people as narco-terrorists, certainly applied to Aceh, where there was a lot of tendency to say that the insurgents in Aceh were also peddling in drugs. They probably were. Aceh is a major area of marijuana cultivation. In fact, one of the biggest areas in Southeast Asia of marijuana cultivation. But the reality is that they were elected in power, and now they are government officials. The insurgents are now government officials. So, you know, they still might be in the drug trade, but they are no longer terrorists. Then you have all these various offshoot in Jamaa Islamiya, who I think the verdict is out how much they have penetrated these various drug markets. Indonesia has become one of the leading Asian producers of methamphetamines. And it's a market that's up for grab for everyone. So will some of these terrorist groups that are very small, actually, if active, try to penetrate it perhaps, but you know I don't think they control the market in any robust way. It's not like the market is, the meth market is carved up by Jamaa Islamiyah or the offshoots of Jamaa Islamiyah. But yes, there is a lot of pot in Aceh.
Let's get a couple more questions. I know we've only got about 15, 20 minutes going around.
Hi. I just want to echo the thanks. It was really, really fascinating. And I'm going to focus in on Indonesia for a second, too, and I apologize if others are interested in other parts of the world. I'm Nancy Human. I work on the Climate Change Initiative, and one of our main grantees is an entity that we helped start up, the Climate Policy Initiative. They've been working really closely with the Indonesian government to try to design parts of the REDD+ system and to enable the Norway investment to be done in a constructive way. And they're working both at the national level, but also because of the way that has been structured at the provincial level with the Central Kalimantan government, which has been designated a pilot province.
Yeah.
So I was really interested to hear sort of a number of the themes in your talk. I mean, one thing that they're definitely trying to come to terms with is this question about what to do about alternative livelihoods, because there are a huge number of people who are making, sort of scratching out livings illegally. And, you know, some people who are not so much scratching out, but who you have to figure out a way to dislodge in order to develop the system that might replace the current situation. So, I mean, this may not be the best forum to go into a lot of detail about your findings, but I would love to, if you're game to do it, to put you in touch with the people who are thinking about these systems more from the government point of view, because they're looking at it from the government's point of view, but sort of finding the same thing you're finding. And I wonder whether, like, a conversation would lead to some deeper thinking about solutions that might actually work. So there were cases where you suggested that there were small areas of success, and it would be interesting, I think, for them to learn from you about the elements of those successes and the degree to which you think they could be replicated in different places on a larger scale, et cetera. And then in connection with that, they also do comparative policy analysis across a number of different geographies. And so I'm wondering whether there are lessons to be learned from the Indonesia context that might be applicable in a place like the Congo or Liberia or other places where forests are now under quite a lot of stress because Indonesia, you know, has some limitations. Although there's plenty of logging still to be done in Indonesia if people wanted to. So this is more in the way of a comment, and you know, if you want to make some comments here, that would be great. But I think there is a sort of deeper, longer conversation to be had with the Climate Policy Initiative.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'll be very glad to be in touch. Let me just make a few comments that might be more interesting. I think one area that was key to the law, to the small success cases, was the level of community cohesion. If you have cohesive communities, then bringing in an NGO to start mobilizing might be very effective. One of the big problems with Indonesia, of course, is that the transmigration policy encouraged these massive movements of people throughout the islands that generated both a lot of social strife but really broke up communities. And so lots of the poor loggers and miners will be people who quite expect to be kicked out from an area, but just like the police that is stationed somewhere for 6 months and needs to make money within the 6 months, their expectation is we don't care about whether the forest is destroyed and in the long term we will not be able to get food for our family. What we expect to be here 2 years, and in these 2 years we want to make money and then we are going to move out somewhere else. So when you lose this community cohesion, protest action or effective mobilization action becomes very difficult. Let me leave it at that, and then there's a lot of the themes that we can talk specifically about Red Plus and logging and limitations of Red Plus and how I think they need to be redesigned. Just one last comment I would make on that is the regulatory framework is very important. That's where NGOs can help. That's where the Norwegians can help.
Yeah.
But it becomes almost meaningless if it's not being implemented. And that's where Jakarta needs to come in, and Jakarta has not been willing. So Jakarta has learned to make very good speeches and capitalized on the fact that deforestation has slowed because a lot of the trees are gone.
Right.
But when it comes to cracking down on misbehavior in local areas, they have been very meek and apathetic. And so, you know, here the story is once again about the enforcement implementation of the regulatory framework, not just about the regulatory framework. And there's lots of components too.
Great, thank you.
Hi, my name is Javed. I work with the Afghan-Pakistan program here. You mentioned that alternative livelihood approaches almost always has failed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was certainly the case in Afghanistan where I come from. And the reason, my understanding is it was because the international community out of carrot and stick, only use the carrot part. And a lot of farmers, just when we provided aid money for in place of whatever they were doing, they said, oh, more money, let me take this too. So there was nothing kind of pressure or anything, any obligation for them to do the what they were supposed to do. So the bigger problem was, I think, it's the political problem.
Mm-hmm.
United States with international community in NATO, I think they wanted to keep the warlords happy because of the prospect of Taliban coming back. And that was at the cost of this thing being pushed back to 10 years. I worked with the United Nations back there, and then when I heard that the design for opium cultivation would take 10 years, I was shocked. I was like, 10 years? What's this? And now when I looking back at it, I think that they meant never that 10 years, because 10 years war and that's that. Anyway, quickly, my question is, assuming that the United States had not made the warlords happy by not pressuring them to disengage from this activity, do you think that it would have worked by the eradication part, more rigorous sort of sometimes gas bombing of the areas, if not, or prosecuting those who are behind these, or so that was my understanding, and I'm interested what you think that is.
Well, we should have a conversation because I have lived and breathed drugs in Afghanistan for the decade and was very much part of the design of policy. And you're talking to a person who was crucially advocating for stopping eradication in Afghanistan. So blame me if you believe that eradication is the solution. I think eradication would have accomplished anything and would have been deeply counterproductive and would have essentially guaranteed that there would be no chance that counterinsurgency could succeed.
Which it didn't, right?
Well, you know, it's hanging on a thread.
Okay.
It's, you know, counterinsurgency is hanging on a thread, but at least we eliminated eradication intensifying counterinsurgency. Look, eradication across the world has mostly also not worked. Alternative livelihoods have not worked. There is the one big success story, and that's Taiwan. Alternative livelihoods, if they can work, they will not take 10 years, they will take several decades. You're talking about extremely marginalized populations with completely destroyed essential structural elements of an economy. Almost no drug policy, whether eradication or interdiction or eradication, works in the context of active conflict. You almost always have conflict to have ended and very good security before you can see start seeing effectiveness of any policy. Alternative livelihoods take huge amounts of time and are dependent on major structural changes in other aspects of the economy. You can have effective eradication if you are willing to brutalize the population. So if you are Mao and willing to kill several million people, you will end up with the most effective drug policy, drug suppression policy, crop suppression policy, and eradication anywhere in the world. But, you know, do you want to kill several million people? If not, you have to understand that by pushing them with eradication, without giving them alternative means of livelihood, you are really going to generate a lot of social strife, social protest, political instability, and in the context of ethnic, of active insurgency, really solidify the insurgency. On the warlords, yes, it is true that many of the warlords are deeply involved in the drug trade. We have chose to ignore it or to prioritize different issues. From the perspective of U.S. national security, I don't necessarily believe that's wrong. However, I do believe that we often forgive too much, and the fact that we need a warlord for certain activities doesn't mean that we give him blank checks. And very often we have ended up giving them blank checks for everything. So what worries me far more is not whether Matula Khan is peddling in drugs in Uruzgan, but whether he is beating up on all the Gilzai communities in Chora. And what I would really want us to see is to say, yes, we need to work with you. Your powerful Karzai is unwilling to sack you. But we will not work with you in certain ways unless you stop brutalizing the Gilzai community. That, for me, would be far more important priority than whether he is peddling in drugs. At some point, you want to start seeing prosecutions, obviously, but I think you need to achieve a certain political, a certain crucial environment. I can recommend two things. One is that we continue the conversation, you know, offline, and I can send you a lot of my written work. But also, my first book, Shooting Up, was all about how you design effective policies, effective drug policies, especially in the context of insurgency. And the current book on Afghanistan, Aspiration and Ambivalence, has a whole chapter on economic and alternative economic and counter-narcotics policies. What I really don't like about the policy design right now is not so much the design at the strategic level, that I was arguably, to some extent, instrumental in recommending, but in the way it's implemented. Essentially, the money that was supposed to go for alternative livelihoods in Helmand and Kandahar ended up being hundreds of millions of wasted money that showered communities in a way that could not be effectively absorbed, distorted local economies, and focused solely on immediate cash for work short-term programs rather than concentrating on addressing structural drivers of the illegal economy, structural deficiencies in the legal economies, and sustainability. And so the money just not only did not help in terms of alternative livelihoods, it frequently made things worse. But that said, whenever I would start giving a talk on what do you do about drugs in Afghanistan, my first line or second line of the talk was, there is absolutely no chance that there will be less poppy in Afghanistan before 30 years are out. And I'm sticking to that line.
More questions? Thank you. Hi, I'm David Berry from the Justice Initiative. I wonder if you'd be kind enough to talk just a little bit, please, about human trafficking. And specifically, whether it's as dismal, to use your term, as these other economies, and if so, why? I mean, aren't there more...
In general or in Indonesia?
Either.
Okay.
But yeah, aren't there more better regimes in place than, for example, in logging or mining?
So if you look at the broader level, I would say yes. And in some ways, it's an easier economy. Well, in some ways, it's an easier economy to tackle because who could be officially for human trafficking, right? And unlike something like illicit crop cultivation that can employ hundreds of thousands of people in a particular locale and millions of people across the world, human trafficking or smuggling, whether you, if you want to talk solely about people coercedly trafficked or more broadly who just want to be smuggled across the borders, employs fewer people. So you need to think about sort of your management problem, just from a managerial problem. The size is smaller. And there is a lot of focus activity at the UN, at the US, on human trafficking these days. You know, where I think the story becomes complicated is in some of the policies that are being adopted. So in lots of the countries in Asia, South Asia, perhaps even more so than Southeast Asia, there is an implicit assumption built into the policy design that any sexual work is coerced, that you cannot have voluntary choice. And the mentality is rescuing women from sexual work rather than rescuing women from coerced situations. I don't think that's helpful, but it's extremely politically sensitive, explosive, and the debate is very much ideologically intense. And there's a lot of sort of passion that drives the debate. Second, where I don't think the policy is working is in alternative livelihoods once again. So lots of these women who end up in East Asia or Southeast Asia going into prostitution, whether voluntarily or being coerced into prostitution, then they are liberated from the brothels and brought back, often are rejected, shunned by the community. They cannot continue operating there. They will end up moving to a city and often have close to no skill set. Then there is a lot of effort to help them by teaching them alternative livelihood skills. Very frequently that doesn't work. They're being taught things like being a seamstress, in some more imaginative moments. There were, in one case in Nepal, they taught them to be plumbers. The problem was that no Nepali household would hire a female plumber, so their education ended up being completely wasted and they went back to prostitution. Voluntarily, but or voluntarily to the extent that you have no other alternatives. I think where things become most difficult, I also think that what's very problematic about the human trafficking policy design is the focus on information and awareness and the way that these campaigns are done, where there is a built-in assumption that women do not understand that there is a chance that they will be forced into coerced situations. And so there is all these information campaigns and posters being posted or NGOs going to villages. I am not persuaded that works very well. I mean, what I frequently see is huge amounts of discounting of information. It's almost like a replication of the drug prevention campaign telling teenagers, don't do drugs, it will be bad for you. They just discount that information. What works with the drug prevention campaign is telling kids, teenagers, don't do meth, you will become really ugly and you will not have sex. That works. But telling them you will become addicted and you will be a social problem to society, that doesn't work. So these general messaging to women, you might end up being coerced and trafficked, they just don't have traction. I mean, I've seen college-educated women from the Balkans who... They're told, we're looking for a film star, you will really fit this profit. They had college level education, yet they fell for it. So it might not be that it's just the lack of information, but it's the delivery of the information. But I'm not persuaded that simply the informational campaigns are really changing the proclivity of women to allow themselves to become potentially trapped. And the final thing that I think is the most difficult aspect of the of human trafficking issues is not even sexual exploitation, but it's sort of child slavery in Africa, where often you're talking about the traffic victims not even crossing borders, might very well might be taken from southern Mali to northern Mali, or southern Chad to northern Chad, or they're crossing very minimal borders, women or children being, you know, girls being sort of lured, captured, often sold by families. I think that's also one big hole of the policy design, is huge complicitness of families in situations of extreme poverty. Many children, women, families voluntarily sell their kids to prostitution. They might be just trafficked from Nigeria to Mali, or to Nigeria to Chad. And you know, how do you expose that, often given complicity of police? I think there is a sort of biggest role for NGOs, because I don't see any other actors being actively involved in lots of these inner African, sub-Saharan African trafficking situations. I think often get the least coverage, mm-hmm. and have sort of least stakeholders and least visibility, and often great deal of complicity on the part of law enforcement and great deal of complicity on the part of families. Well, how do you dissuade a family from making a decision that, you know, we have five kids, we can only support three? What are we going to do with the two? So, you know, that comes down to better economic empowerment for the entire country and family. Very, very difficult, time-consuming issues. But I also am quite uncomfortable with this notion that there is no voluntary element to sexual work, which you see a lot taking place under the rubric of the anti-human trafficking activism that's taking place. It's very much being connected and sort of intermingling with the notion that all prostitution is can never be a choice. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very problematic assumption, that's hurting these women. And what you really want is to see the women not being stigmatized and being able to have a normal social life if they are. You know, you don't want them to be captured and coerced, obviously, or tortured, right? But you also don't want them to be socially stigmatized. But if you say there's no choice in prostitution, you're making it close to impossible for them to function back mm-hmm. in their families or in their villages and societies.
Maybe the last couple of questions. Not two here.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay. Mine is a sort of a provocative question. There's an emerging school that looks at governance in a less prescriptive way, mm-hmm. sort of in an upside-down view way. And they say that even in circumstances of anarchy, mm-hmm. total disaster, where you have these illegalities, then it's worth studying them, because within that dysfunction, there's something that works.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in the case of these illegal groups, like, I don't know, where some have emerged to fill in gaps, where government is completely absent. Are there some things you think are worth admiring that we as civil society or policymakers in government can adopt? Yeah, what did you admire about how these groups mobilize, how they gain popularity, how they do so much with so little? What can we learn from that?
I'm very good at provocative questions and even much better at provocative statements. I completely endorse and very much sort of join the notion that in many of these settings, there is really no such thing as no regulation or no rules. I once wrote an article called something like "The Rules and Regulations of Illegal Economies." And really, at the core of my work often is the notion that even illegal economies, even very marginal neighborhood slums, really require structures and enforcement of structures and contracts. And if the state doesn't do so, someone else will come in. This is really what gives rise to emergence of mafia and organized crime groups. What they do is, you know, to some extent, what they do is provide the commodity or the transaction that's illegal. But what they do more than anything is provide contract enforcement. And many of these non-state entities, whether they're insurgents or criminal groups or mafias, will start providing a whole set of quote-unquote public or semi-public goods, such as dispute resolution mechanisms that goes even outside of the illegal economy in the community. So in many ways, they take on proto-state functions, and very quickly, sadly or not sadly, the anarchy disintegrates into structures and regulations. I mean, there are very, very few places in the world or very few functional domains that are truly ungoverned. There is a huge innate need for regulation and for providers of contracts and regulation. So I think what the lesson is to policymakers is that what they need to do, or for governments, they need to outcompete these non-state entities in the provision of public goods, if the non-state entities are criminal, abusive, insurgents, for example. If your non-state entity providing regulation is a very benign, fuzzy, cuddly NGO, then you know, perhaps there is no need for the state to come. Although, always from I work with the government, a lot chunk of my work. So I always think that it's good for states to really reach out to citizens and want to be connected, and not say, this population doesn't matter. The NGO is handling it well. Yeah, we often say that's not the right policy for a government, but. But especially if you have actors that generate threats, you want to compete with them. What I would also say, however, is that what is very, in the illicit economies that I was talking about, you have huge variations in the acuteness of threats that they provide. And so there's one thing like thinking about the regulatory regime for illicit drugs, because it's a domain that is undepletable. They will be produced forever and ever. And eventually, human beings, I believe, will arrive at the better system, because they are ultimately very self-regarding. And you have this perfect sort of connection between self-regarding behavior that also will eventually push for self-interested better design. What is very tricky about the logging, poaching, and mining is that you have the enlightened broader interest is often very much at odds with the immediate, short-term, self-interested human impulse. And at the same time, you have economies that you have these resources that are extremely depletable and collapsible. It can take 5 years to eliminate an ecosystem. So you don't have the luxury of sort of trial and error that you have in drug policy regulation, for example, because you are working against these very urgent problems that once the ecosystem is gone, there is no way of bringing it back. Once the species is extinct, it will not be cloned back. And hence, some of the sort of luxury of misdesigning or struggling with design of alternative livelihoods for drug policies have very different levels of acuteness and harm in something like illegal logging or mining to the extent that it affects broader ecosystem or wildlife trafficking, where you have very, very quickly very depletable resource that will be ruined.
We're out of time, but I can ask a few offline.
Yeah, one more, and then we'll have to finish off. Yeah.
But I'm sorry that I missed the email that Eric sent around, so I didn't realize you were here. I don't know if you remember me. I'm Andy Koh from the Drug Policy Project here. Colorado and Washington, and I don't know if you mentioned this already in your talk. I was wondering if you've been thinking about that at all, because one of the things that you were just saying in terms of developing a better way of regulating something that will always be there, that is sort of, at least as far as the United States has gone, and actually really the world other than maybe the Netherlands, well, and a few other places, I shouldn't say that. It's really, that's about as far as we've gone, and we're just about to try to figure out how to actually do that. And then is the federal government involved in all that? I just wondering if you've been thinking about that.
So, okay, then, there are so many different dimensions, Danny, that we can have to the conversation. So, first of all, the Colorado legislation is far more than any other model. It's far more than the Dutch, because it's full legalization. I was talking a little bit about the Dutch model and what it actually said. So this is really full-blown legalization, first time since China at the turn of the century. And of course, it's totally in violation of federal law. So there's this big fight on the books that's going to happen. And I'm sure that it's one of the things on Eric Holder's docket that he is probably really interested in. Look, I I am quite sanguine and possibly positive and optimistic about the implications for users. So certainly the fact that users will not be exposed to illegal markets, I think, is good. And also removing them from something like enforcement and punitive action, I think it's very, very desirable. I am very sort of open and neutral at this point, and I really don't know what impact that will have on the consumption of other drugs. I think there are a lot of kinks and twists to the marijuana gateway theory, many of which I don't hold. So if there is a replication of the Dutch, that this will separate potential users from harder drugs, I think that's wonderful. Especially if you see some sort of effects on meth market, which is big in the Midwest, if that goes down, that would be fantastic. I think the verdict is out whether that will happen. When it comes to other policies, you know, will this have an impact on drug cartels in Mexico? I become very, very skeptical about that. So, you know, first of all, you just have two states, right? But you could potentially imagine the cascading effect through other states, and you could imagine the marijuana market in the U.S. being supplied completely from the U.S. at some point. Do I believe that this will end drug violence or the activity of organized crime groups in Mexico? The answer is no. What that will do is intensify their fights over other thieves and over other commodities, whether they are legal or illegal. Do I believe they will be bankrupt? No. There's big sort of arguments about is it 20% or 40% that they get out of pot. But even if it was 40%, there's still a lot of money to be made in Mexico out of other behavior. Then the question is how much the states will be able to tax, and that depends on how much you will have cultivation emerging that will try to evade taxes, and how many law enforcement, IRS or other, it will take to now be cracking down on the marijuana cultivation that's emerging and where the owners are not paying the taxes. So, you know, to say that a commodity is legal doesn't mean that enforcement ends. You still want the legal businesses to behave in a certain way, just like you need regulation, oversight, and enforcement against bankers in New York. I don't have enough, but right? The fact that it's legal doesn't mean that that's the end of law enforcement. And you know, if pot went legal in Mexico, again, I am really skeptical that this would have big effects on violence, corruption, police quality at all, unless you saw major improvements in rule of law. So I would reverse the trade. If Mexico wants to go legal, they first need to fix their non-functioning law enforcement and justice system and develop some deterrence capacity so you don't end up with criminal groups that are as blatant and abusive and violent as they are in Mexico. My last concluding word is you can have badly managed illegal economies and you can have well-managed illegal economies. You can have badly managed legal ones and well-managed legal ones. Part of the story is regulatory framework, but it's only a part of the story. The other part is law enforcement capacity and justice capacity and rule of law. And they apply equally to legal commodities as they do to illegal ones.
Thank you very much. It's absolutely clear that your incredibly detailed research is going to affect many different areas of the work that OSF does. And so we look forward to your publication coming out, and hopefully we'll have you back again once we've all read it to ask you even more questions. So thank you very much indeed for coming today.